And welcome to Law Matters for another fortnight here on Noongar Radio. Wherever you're listening in Perth or throughout regional Western Australia, or in fact nationally via the National Indigenous Radio Service, welcome to the program. Comes to you fortnightly by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Jodie Hoffman with you for this hour. So a big program coming up. Very, very shortly we're going to be finding out about the National Indigenous Legal Conference. Perth is the host city for this conference this year. Really important conference. Lots of great speakers coming up and plenary sessions. We're going to be chatting with Mel Thomas from the University of Western Australia. So do stay tuned wherever you're listening around the country. This may be something that is right up your alley to start packing your bags and heading to Perth for. It's on the 25th and 26th of September in Perth, the National Indigenous Legal Conference. But before that, we're going to be finding out about a very important report that was launched earlier today, a new report shedding the light on disadvantage for stolen generations and their descendants. The new report, which has been collated by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, has uncovered chronic health issues, disability and alarming levels of economic and social disadvantage of our stolen generations. Do stay tuned. I'm going to be having a chat with a fella by the name of Richard Weston, who is on the eastern coast of Australia. He's the CEO of the Healing Foundation. That's coming up in the second half of this program, so stay tuned. This is Law Matters for another fortnight, and people are gearing up for the 13th annual National Indigenous Legal Conference as we speak. Lots of preparation underway, and it's 13 years on since the inaugural conference was held back in Sydney. So we are the host city, Perth, and we want to see as many people get along and show them what a great conference this town can put on. So I thought I would get on the program a fella who is known to, well, many of our Aboriginal lawyers in this state. His name is Mel Thomas, and he's with the University of Western Australia. Mel, how are you?
I'm really well, Jodie. How are you going?
I'm going really well, and we're going to talk about the National Indigenous Legal Conference, which, of course, you're very involved in. But before we do that, I mentioned that you're well known to quite a few of our Aboriginal lawyers here in Western Australia. Tell us why.
Well, we've had a long-standing relationship with students and as a student and as a tutor for 20 years. So I've seen many of our graduates go on to do great things, and they're in regular contact with me. They come and visit the school. They give us, the whole school actually is proud of their achievements, and they visit a lot of staff, including me, Jill Milroy, the Pro Vice Chancellor, Gabe Garrett, who provides a lot of support to all our students, and yes, they're now coming back, a lot of them, to participate at the National Indigenous Legal Conference.
And I know that a lot of our lawyers at the ALS in Perth and in regional Western Australia went through their law courses at the University of Western Australia, and it's a fantastic thing to see more Aboriginal people getting out into the courtrooms and sort of breaking down the barriers a lot between Aboriginal people and culture and the justice system, which gets pretty complex. So a lot of clients at the end of the day are very happy to see an Aboriginal lawyer or court officer there to give them a hand.
Indeed. And our Aboriginal lawyers are really doing well in terms of staying in the profession and thriving in the profession. So that's wonderful to hear. And, I'm just hearing wonderful stories about their work, their contribution to their community, their contribution to public life, their contribution to developing legal arguments for the benefit of our Aboriginal people.
Mel, for a long time you were involved in the Indigenous Law course at the University of Western Australia, but you're wearing a new hat these days. Tell us about that.
Several hats. Yes, so I'm still the tutor or coordinator for Aboriginal law students at UWA who are doing a Juris Doctor, which is the postgraduate law degree in 3 years. And we've got students in that qualification who are doing very well. So I'm responsible for their academic progress as well as I'm also coordinating the Indigenous Knowledge, History and Heritage major. I've been doing this for 4 years, which is an undergraduate major at the university. So we have many students enrolling into our units from across the uni, non-Indigenous students, international students from Canada, from America, from the Netherlands, and they're studying Aboriginal ways of knowing in our units.
Good stuff. I'm chatting with Mel Thomas from the University of Western Australia. 13 years ago, a little old conference happened in Sydney. That was the first National Indigenous Legal Conference. It has grown remarkably over the last decade or so, and Perth is the host city for this conference on the 25th and 26th of September. It will be opened. Will there be a Welcome to Country by Dr. Richard Walley, OAM, very known not just around Western Australia and Australia, but internationally for his contributions to Aboriginal dance, music and cultural matters. An incredible performer. So a great start to an exciting conference.
It will be a great start, and it is an exciting conference. You mentioned that it was 2000, is it, that the first one was started, I think, or 2005?
13 years ago, so 2005.
Yeah. 2005. I think I remember going to that conference myself. The conferences have changed over the years. I was speaking to Dennis about this the other day, and I guess it's moved away from practitioners and what they're doing. And of course, there was always an element of Aboriginal rights issues in these conferences towards I think what the title says it all. Sovereign Laws, Peoples and Voices is the name of our conference. And in terms of coming a long way, well, the conference is really a safe space for Aboriginal people to talk about the issues, legal issues affecting their communities, what sovereignty means to them, and it's a safe space for that to occur for our law students, for our lawyers, our alumni, Indigenous lawyers throughout the country.
Let's break that down, Mel. Sovereign laws, peoples and voices. For the benefit of our listeners, what does that title encapsulate in terms of what the conference is focusing on?
Well, it's up to people to interpret it as they and their communities want. So whilst we have guest speakers who will be speaking about sovereign law, like Irene Watson, Professor Irene Watson, there are also other emerging rights debates within the community, such as the Uluru Statement from the Heart, where constitutional Indigenous law experts like Megan Davis went to Aboriginal communities to hear their voices about what needs to happen to change the Constitution, to reform the Constitution, and their ideas are now critical, I guess, to informing the wider community about what Aboriginal people want. So it's up to people to determine what these words mean, but ultimately it's their show. In other words, there's a dialogue occurring, and we want to facilitate that dialogue on sovereignty and what it means for Aboriginal people, be it law, be it their right to have a voice to the Australian nation, and their sovereignty as people. And I'll in a little bit later, I'll read out an abstract which really kind of identifies those themes from one of our professors. And would you like me to read that out now?
Yeah, which professor is that?
This is Professor Irene Watson.
Irene's a research professor of law, pro vice chancellor, Aboriginal leadership and strategy at the University of South Australia. So it'd be great to get other views from around the country. So tell us about Irene, what she's going to be talking about.
Well, Irene is an eminent public intellectual and law scholar, and she's written prolifically about Aboriginal sovereignty. She's been involved in the United Nations. She's writing, and I'll quote from her abstract, she says, "We are many First Nations. We are still living. Our laws cannot be extinguished, for our laws, our law ways are cyclical and ongoing. But she then goes, the colonial narrative dominates while our Aboriginal laws and philosophies continue to centre the lives of many Aboriginal peoples. This paper will consider how we might know more of whom we are and make our space for what is, what was first and how we might continue to regain our Aboriginal place. So in many respects, this is a kind of a reflection, I guess, of the self-determination principles underlying the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
And
on the ground.
Yeah, and also the highlights the ongoing journey that we're all on to sort of keep striving in this country. Irene will be very exciting to see. You mentioned Dennis earlier. Dennis Eggington is also one of the keynote speakers. And we'll speak it with more depth with Dennis Eggington, CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service, between now and the conference about what he'll be talking. But you've also got someone else who's been very involved in the legal service for many years, the Honourable Robert French, AC, the Chancellor of the University of Western Australia. Tell us what he's talking about.
Well, he's given us a wonderful title. And it's called Simple Justice, Sovereignty and Reform. So these are the key issues, I guess, in the debates that are occurring in Aboriginal communities. And so that's the first keynote speech. And it's wonderful coming from a former Chief Justice of the High Court and the Chancellor of the University. So we're delighted to have him involved in this conference.
And someone who was so involved in the early years of the Aboriginal Legal Service when it was setting up back in the 1970s. And we actually Robert French on board when the history book about the Aboriginal Legal Service was launched, Justice, a book by Dr. Fiona Skyring, and thought it was very...
I have a copy of it right in front of me.
Good, good, good. so it's, which is going back a few years now, but there's an incredible lot of people who have been so involved in the justice system over the years and striving for the rights of Aboriginal peoples in Western Australia and I guess across Australia through the National Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Legal Services. This really is a conference with national appeal and we hope a big mob head over to Perth for the 25th and 26th of September to take part in the National Indigenous Legal Conference. Great to see that the MC for the couple of days is Ashley Truscott, who is a former lawyer of the Aboriginal Legal Service and a student of law in Western Australia many years ago.
And he still is. He's doing postgraduate studies, Master of Laws. Always, he's got a very keen scholarly mind and is learning all the time. And he's an awesome, absolutely awesome MC. He gave a guest lecture last year at the Octagon in a unit, Aboriginal Encounters, which I coordinate, on the history of reconciliation, and it was a fantastic lecture. So he combines law and social and historical justice issues in his presentations, and he's a very good guest speaker. I might also add he is a marriage celebrant.
Yes, he is. I'm wondering also if he's the first Aboriginal marriage celebrant. I'm sure if he's not, someone will let us know. But, yeah, another feather to his cap.
Indeed. Indeed, yes.
Mel, I know that the conference for the 2 days is chock-a-block. There's too much to go through. But what are some other highlights that you're really looking forward to and you want to let our listeners know about?
Well, we're looking forward to hearing from students and practitioners, and we've called for abstracts. So that people from all over the country, from their communities, can write an abstract, and there's no right or wrong in terms of the content. It's how they interpret it. So sovereign laws, peoples, and voices are broad themes, and we are really looking forward to and we're getting some really dynamic abstracts coming through from people and their communities. What's relevant to them? So it's a platform for Aboriginal voices, sovereign voices, to actually be heard. And we're getting these abstracts coming in all the time. And listeners, those of you who want to present, you're more than welcome to submit an abstract. We will get you back within 5 days, confirmation of when you'll be presenting, what time, and it will give you an extra voice at the conference. So we don't want a top-down approach at this conference. It is to facilitate a dialogue, so that's one of the things I'm looking forward to. We're looking forward to the gala dinner, obviously.
Of course.
So some networking, some socialising. We're getting a band involved. This will be at the Hyatt, and so we're looking forward to that as a social event. We're looking forward to our alumni at UWA participating at all conference sessions. And, I guess at the end of the day, we're looking to see if other people are listening in to the conference, are listening to what's being said. And, you know, I'm thinking of government departments. I'm thinking of politicians informed by Aboriginal voices from this conference itself.
So while it is the National Indigenous Legal Conference, of course, the doors are open to everybody.
They are open, and the conference is welcoming of new speakers, because we've got plenary sessions running for 2 days. And so people are sending us abstracts now. We're getting one from Tony McAvoy, who is the chair of the National Indigenous Lawyers Committee. For example, he'll be presenting. We're getting abstracts from our graduates, so they're coming in too as well. And so the final program will be revealed in a few weeks before the actual conference starts. So if people have a look at the website, they can see it's got its keynote speakers, it's got its plenary sessions, and in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, we'll have it all full with all the guest speakers from around the nation.
Good stuff. Mel, I know it's going to be a dynamic couple of days at the University of Western Australia, the National Indigenous Legal Conference 2018, the 13th one of its kind. This year's theme, Sovereign Laws, Peoples and Voices. Do get along. Prices are very reasonable for registration. And if you would like to find out more about how to register, you can phone Julie on 07 55 80 8677. And if you want to find out about the conference and sponsorship, phone Caroline on 08 64 88 7658. If you didn't have a pen to do those details, just Google National Indigenous Legal Conference 2018. It'll take you straight to the University of Western Australia, the site, with all the speakers known to date of who'll be talking. Exciting times, 25th and 26th of September. Who would you encourage to get along to this conference, Mel?
I would encourage Aboriginal lawyers, policymakers, academics, people involved in government departments, those who are studying socio-legal issues, not necessarily a law degree, postgraduate students, and I guess, we're welcome to hear from community leaders as well. So it's a legal conference, but it involves not just lawyers, but students and policymakers.
Good stuff. So if you are interested in getting along to the National Indigenous Legal Conference, contact the University of Western Australia for more information. We'll also put the info on our Aboriginal Legal Service Facebook page, so you can check that out. We'll make sure that's updated later today. I know we've done a few things to do with it, but we'll update it after this interview. And Mel, great to talk to you. It's been a few years between chats here on Law Matters, but all the best with the conference. And I know these things don't come together by themselves, so I'm sure there's a cast of dedicated people behind the scenes pulling everything together.
Well, the School of Indigenous Studies is heavily involved and promoting, and of course we've got our wonderful staff involved and the committee working tirelessly to ensure that this conference is a wonderful success and is a positive step for giving Aboriginal people, Aboriginal lawyers, their rightful place in the national conversation about their rights.
Good stuff. And Perth does it pretty well, we've got to admit.
Well, I always say that, you know, the West Australians are an amazing bunch. I really recommend all people from the country come along, not just from Western Australia, but from other parts of the country. If there's any issues with, for example, people who have concession, to contact me if there's any issue with the registration fees, because we're aware that some people may not be able to afford a conference and that they may be entitled to concession rates.
Good stuff. Mel Thomas, I'll give out your number if you don't mind, your landline, if people do want to follow up with that with you directly. Is that okay?
Most certainly.
So you're at the University of WA. For those outside of the state, the area code is 08 and your landline is 64882973, 64882973. But you can also find that on the University of WA website as well. Mel Thomas, all the best with it. Looking forward to a dynamic couple of days in Perth, 25th and 26th of September, the 13th National Indigenous Legal Conference. Thank you for your time today on Law Matters.
My pleasure, Jodie. Take care.
Mel Thomas from the UWA. So get involved. You can actually get involved. Put your interest in if you're interested in being a plenary speaker, or pack those bags and head along to Perth to take part in this exciting conference. This is Law Matters, brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, each fortnight here on Noongar Radio. But a big hello to our regional stations in Western Australia listening through and rebroadcasting this show as well. Hello to the mob up around Fitzroy Crossing, listening in through Wonky Radio, and Kalgoorlie and surrounds through Tumapulka. And in the south of the state through Albany Community Radio. Great to have you all on board, as it is our national listeners through the National Indigenous Radio Service. A very important report has just been launched, a report that sheds the light on the disadvantage for our stolen generations and descendants. Very shattering news, I guess, that was known to a lot of us. I mean, Stolen Generations is close to the hearts for so many of our mob, but the report in black and white highlights just how hard it is the times are facing our mob who are Stolen Generations. I'm going to be speaking with a fella in a moment from Healing, the Healing Foundation, and the foundation is a very important organisation. The journey of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Healing Foundation began in 1997 when the Bringing Them Home report, a report of the National Inquiry into the separation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, was tabled in federal parliament. And amongst its many recommendations was that healing should be included in wellbeing services provided to members of the Stolen Generations. Richard Weston is the CEO of the Healing Foundation, and he joins us on the line. Richard, thank you so much for your time on the program. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Jodie. It's good to be with you.
Before we talk about the report and its findings, Richard, let's find out a little bit more about you.
Sure. Look, I'm a Torres Strait man by heritage. I belong to the Meriam people of Murray Island. But you'll be interested to know that I grew up in Western Australia on Noongar Boodja. So, my father was from WA, and we were, the family moved there very early on in my life, and so I spent my, did all my schooling in Western Australia, went to university, but left WA, left Perth in 1996, and moved across to Barkindji country, and lived in Broken Hill for 13 years. I've spent a bit of time up in Brisbane, but now I'm based in Canberra. I've been here for the last 9 years, and on the country of the Ngunnawal people. So I've been around, and I've also spent time up in the Pilbara in my early 20s. So I know WA fairly well, and I have a lot of friends there. And I'm really pleased to be able to talk about this report today.
Yeah, it's a new report. It's only been launched earlier today, a new report from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare that highlights the urgent need to overhaul policies and services for our stolen generations and tackle the impact of intergenerational trauma in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. I guess that we at the Aboriginal Legal Service deal with many members of the stolen generation who come through the doors and need our services, and I'm looking at these stats and seeing that there's very good reason for that, because tell us about some of the stats that have come out of this report in terms to how tough our stolen generations really do have it.
Well, what this report does, it's the first detailed demographic study of our stolen generations population and their descendants. And the report, as you said in your introduction, has uncovered an alarming level of social and economic disadvantage. But it estimates that around 17,000 members of the stolen generations are living across Australia today, and that they experience higher levels of adversity in relation to 38 key health and welfare outcomes. And these were the outcomes that were analysed in this report. And, you know, look, just to give you an idea, we for example, stolen generations are three times as likely to have been in jail in the last 5 years. They're twice as likely to rely on government payments to survive, and they're 1.6 times more likely to be in poor health. So, and this comparison of disadvantages with other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people of the same age group who weren't removed. So this is just a comparison between stolen generations and other Aboriginal people. And, you know, when we make that comparison with the border population, the picture is much worse. But it is giving us, I think, for the first time, it's pulling together a large set of data that's telling us what, you know, what is the real impact of forcibly removing tens of thousands of children from their families, from their communities, and from their culture. And it's also telling us a lot about the descendants of stolen generations who are also experiencing disproportionate levels of trauma and, you know, poor health and social outcomes.
It's always difficult, Richard, to talk stats on the radio. It becomes a sort of blur of numbers and all that, and it can be a little bit tricky to keep up with. But these are really important stats that do highlight the tragic impact of past policies. And I do want to go through some of these. 67% of our stolen generations live with a disability or restrictive long-term condition. 70% rely on government payments as the main source of income. 66% live in households within the three lowest income percentages. 40% have experienced homelessness in the past 10 years. 91% never completed year 12. 62% of working age are not employed. And 39% over the age of 50 report poor mental health. The flow-ons of any or all of those situations has to lead to poorer health and not very good outcomes for a lot of our mob, hey?
Look, that's true. I think, you know, when stolen generations were removed from their families, they were children. So they experienced that trauma of being removed from their families, but then they were isolated from their culture, from their community, from their languages. They were placed into institutions, and in those institutions they experienced all sorts, you know, a range of different forms of abuse and neglect. And that's where the trauma began for the stolen generations. And because those children had they weren't nurtured, they weren't cared for properly in those institutions, they had no opportunity to heal from that trauma. And what we know is that the impact of trauma on children affects their physical health and affects the development of their brain. And those impacts are long-lasting. They affect the way they function as people, so it affects their physical, social, emotional, spiritual well-being. It affects the way they relate to other people. They are often living often fearful and mistrustful of institutions, and I think we can understand why based on their treatment. But those impacts are without healing last a lifetime. And what we know about trauma is that it gets passed down from one generation to another, just through those behaviours. So stolen generations, people who are cut off from their cultural knowledge about parenting and so forth, start when they started raising their children, their traumas had an impact on their own children. And that's one of the issues that stolen generations continually raise with us, is the is to ensure that their families get access to healing. And that's another element of this report that's important, that one third of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander adults in Australia today are descendants of the stolen generations. And, you know, as you've just outlined some of those particular telling pieces of data that are included in this report, it just shows that there's this really high level of this burden of trauma, this burden of disadvantage that is being carried by, you know, those stolen generations that are still alive, but it's being passed on to their families. And really, you know, it means we have, you know, we have a significant challenge and a significant problem on our hands.
I'm chatting with Richard Weston, who is CEO of the Healing Foundation, and we're talking about a report released earlier today about stolen generations here in Australia, and very tragic numbers highlighting the characteristics and outcomes of a lot of our mob who were affected either directly as stolen generations themselves or through the intergenerational trauma, which we know is still very, very real. And it's very evident in our work of our legal services across the country. You mentioned that more likely to be incarcerated, and we certainly see those in the stats, really alarming stats here in Western Australia as it is across the country. It was interesting to see the breakdown of stolen generations recorded across the country. Western Australia was one of the highest, I think, outside of New South Wales.
Well, look, WA's, I think, is an important case. I mean, one in four, almost one in four, so 24% of Aboriginal adults in Western Australia are stolen generations, and 46% of Aboriginal adults in WA are descendants of stolen generations, so almost half. So I think for WA, that has major implications for Indigenous affairs policy and services across the board. You know, from, as you know, in your domain, in legal services, it certainly means that you're dealing with, more traumatised people that are coming into contact with the law, and that becomes problematic, and it does result in more of our people going into those juvenile systems, juvenile justice systems, and adult prison systems. And this is a very real impact of trauma, and that's what this report is telling us. It shows us the direct impact between that stolen generation's experience of forced removal and the lived experience of trauma in the lives of our people. And Western Australia is... I think has a much higher burden probably than some of the other states. And look, and you'll be interested to know that some other work that we're doing that's related to this. This report is part of an action plan for healing that the Healing Foundation is working on to take back to government. But another piece of work is some qualitative studies. And one of the things that we've found is that across Australia, there are around 416 institutions where, stolen generations were placed in. And nearly half of those are found in Western Australia. So WA certainly has, a significant trauma history, that's impacting on the Aboriginal population there today, and certainly presents, major challenges for policymakers, for service providers, and for our own Aboriginal institutions.
Yeah, the report highlighted current failures in delivering effective and accessible solutions. Example, almost a third of stolen generations reported having problems accessing services, and they and their descendants are one and a half times likely as to report access difficulties rather than other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and that's largely because of lack of appropriate healing services across areas where we now know that the stolen generations and their poor and their families live. And so a lot of that is poor accessibility, of course, with a state as large as Western Australia, that is a daily problem. The Healing Foundation, the work of what you guys are doing is incredible, as is Yokai here in Perth, run by Jim Morrison. Ironically, out of the offices of our former Chief Protector A. O'Neville at 57 Murray Street in Perth, a reclamation of a building used for evil to be used now for healing of our mob.
Yeah, well, I have visited those offices of Jim a couple of years ago. Jim proudly showed me around, but you do get an eerie feeling there, and you suspect that if A.O. Neville walked through the door and saw Jim Morrison sitting up there, he'd probably have a fit. But, I think there's some huge challenges there for, those stolen generations organisations in Western Australia. But it's great to see that, there is resources coming into some of those communities, some of those old missions to establish healing centres and locally led healing solutions. And I think, and that's what this report really, I think, is telling us, that as you said, access to services is challenging for stolen generations and their descendants. But to really heal the this profound level of trauma that we're seeing through this report and what we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, we really have to work closely with our communities. We have to build their leadership in healing. We have to build their capability. We have to enable them to lead the healing in their own communities and their own families. And because I don't think we're going to solve these problems just by improving or creating more services, because accessing services is a problem. So we've got to go and work with the people in their environment. Use what expertise we have. We have a culture that's thousands of years old. So we have strengths that we can build on. And healing is a strengths-based approach to tackling trauma. It engages the people that are most effective in the leadership and the creation of solutions. And I think that's the sort of effort the Healing Foundation wants to get behind and do everything that we can to support that, whether that's through providing resources or, providing knowledge and expertise to help people to plan and think about how they take that forward. But I think there's challenges for all states across the board, but I think Western Australia has some, particular challenges based on the history of that state.
And yeah, we really do need to turn the ship around, because the disadvantage doesn't end with our stolen generations. Of course, we've talked about that the negative impact is having flow-on effects to family members throughout the generations. And when you look at the report, I mean, I guess it did come out with a lot of things that I guess a lot of us already knew, but when you actually see it written down, that more likely to have experienced discrimination in the last 12 months, more likely to have experienced violence, more likely to be in poor health, more likely to be arrested by the police, more likely to have low levels of trust in the general community, more likely to report poor mental health if they reported at all, and more likely to have used substances. You only have to look around, Richard, and I guess it's the same where you are and our brothers and sisters across the country, that the homeless toll is growing, drug abuse is spiralling. We need to get in now and put strategies in place to help our mob stand proud, hey?
Yeah, we have to break that cycle of trauma. We've had some really important efforts in the policy space around closing the gap and those sort of things. But what we've learned over the last 10 years is that change isn't happening fast enough, and in some of the targets under Close the Gap we've just failed to meet milestones. So, and there's been no explanation given as to why we haven't made progress on closing the gap, and we're in a process now where that policy space is being refreshed, and there's consultations going around the country. But what has come through those consultations And there's been 18 roundtables with, you know, service providers, community members and so forth, different stakeholders. But overwhelmingly people have identified trauma and healing as a priority and racism and discrimination. So, you know, I think it's, and, you know, and I think the government, to their credit, have committed to that process of listening and hearing from Aboriginal people. But I guess the proof will be in the pudding is if we can ensure that we have strategies in place to really tackle that cycle of trauma and support that, you know, that local level community-based healing so that we can create safe environments for our children and our families and start to overcome this trauma and you know, get more out of our lives and you know, make sure the future's a lot brighter than, you know, perhaps, you know, what the situation has been for quite a long time.
This is a very important report, and we only have a couple of minutes left on our program, but it's a very important report launched earlier today. We have put links and information up on it on the Aboriginal Legal Service of WA Limited Facebook page, so you can find information there, or you can go to the Healing Foundation website as well. Richard Weston, when you see a report like this, what does it inspire you in terms of what happens next?
Well, look, the important thing to remember, this report was commissioned through the Healing Foundation, but it was funded by the government. So the minister's interested. He's seen the report. He's waiting for the Healing Foundation to come back to him with an action plan for healing. And I'm talking about the federal minister, Minister Scullion. But we've certainly written to all his counterparts in the states and territories. So we want to come and talk to those people in Western Australia and other states about this report and what it might mean. But look, I'm just hopeful that we can build on the strengths of our culture. We, you know, we have the strongest living culture in the world, and that has to be something that we can use to help us turn a lot of these these statistics that are in this report, turn a lot of those situations around. And I think you know, our own Indigenous institutions, like our legal services, like our health services, are going to play, as they always have, but they'll continue to play a critical role in fixing up these problems.
It's a very comprehensive report. It's great that it's out. Gives us all a better starting point to know where to from here. The work of the Healing Foundation is incredible, and you must be very proud to be involved in such an organisation that partners with communities to heal the trauma caused by the disruption of our mob and cultures and languages over the last 230 years. Rewarding work, hey?
Look, it is, and, you know, look, big responsibility as well, but, you know, just the privilege to interact and hear the stories of our stolen generations and other community members. I mean, as much as we have a lot of challenges, when I travel around to communities, I see a lot of strengths, I see leadership, I see people who want to see change. I see young people coming through who are very proud of their culture, very connected with their identity, and those are things that we can build on. And I think that we can, over time, turn these challenges around and really break the cycle of this trauma.
Yeah, which would be absolutely fantastic. So it is thanks to organisations like the Healing Foundation and also Yokai here in Western Australia and bringing them home, and a great deal of organisations around the country who are passionate about making a difference and righting the wrongs of the past. Richard, been lovely to meet you, and let us know next time you're in Perth, because we'd love to get you in on the program for a chat in the studios here at Noongar Radio. A very important report, so well done to the Healing Foundation for playing a major role in this report. And it's great that you've got the government sitting up and listening, and that can lead to really positive things, hey?
Well, here's hoping, Jodie. So we'll see where we land in a few months' time.
Good on you.
Thank you very much.
Richard Weston, thanks for your time here on Law Matters.
Thank you.
Richard Weston, CEO of the Healing Foundation, joining us. We are out of time. If you would like more information about that, head to the Healing Foundation website or the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia Limited Facebook page. All information about our program today on that page. You can hear this program again on Sunday night or on Tuesday through the National Indigenous Radio Service. Thanks for your company. Jodie Hoffman saying, see you later for now.